Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. We're doing Money and Markets. We're recording on January 31st for publication on Thursday, February 1st. The theme is so dead on. What's the theme, John?
The pretend is over.
Wow, is it ever. But that doesn't stop the establishment from throwing money at trying to get it to not be over. But the money and the complexity being thrown to keep the narrative going is just mind-boggling.
Nor does it stop the powers that be from doubling down on strategies that, that are adjudicated failures.
Right, right. So I don't know. You know, it's the pushback versus, well, I don't know. This is going to be a very incoherent, wild year. It's off to a good start.
Yeah, and again, the pushback come on from all quarters, which has been the case, you know, in every episode this year, and this week in particular, we're going to see it big time from the judiciary, and not just in the U.S., but from all over the world.
Yeah. Well, more and more people are beginning to realize that this fight is for all the marbles. So
yeah. Right.
Okay.
I think that's right. And that's another thing we see is that this is people are like realizing we need to go to the mat over this.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
okay. Let's get into it with, you know, we've let off for a few weeks now, a few months really, with genocide in Gaza. And we lead off there again where we have, you know, a judicial opinion from the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. But I want to click first over. I'm going to show the ruling itself because you can't trust the media. And here's why. This is from the Wall Street Journal. We don't need to go past the headline. The World Court rejects demand for Gaza ceasefire. Huh, that's interesting. Because South Africa didn't ask for a ceasefire, nor could the court have granted a ceasefire. Because ceasefires apply to nations and apply to armies. This is an army, namely the IDF, fighting and killing en masse civilians. So there's no ceasefire to be had. South Africa, if you read the opinion, the word fire isn't even in the opinion at all. So the word ceasefire isn't in the opinion at all. The word cease is in there once. But anyway, let's cut to the opinion itself and see what it says. This is interesting. I just want to highlight some key points in this opinion. You can see the order came out January 26th. That's within the last 2 weeks since our last episode. South Africa versus Israel. It was South Africa who brought the case. And they get right into it. And I want to highlight this introduction that says Hamas and other armed groups carried out an attack killing more than 1,200 persons. That's interesting because not even Israel is any longer standing by 1,200 people dead. And they also talk about abducting people, hostages. That's important because what the court is doing, it's kind of a conservative court. They're playing it conservatively here saying, we're going to assume that everything you've told us, the worst case scenario, is true. And we're going to proceed from that basis. And the court still finds a genocide. Now, you got to realize this case, the procedural posture of this case is kind of like in the U.S. It's preliminary. It's not a full case on the merits. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a preliminary injunction where they're going to kind of take a preview of the evidence, a sort of a proffer of the evidence and say, you know, does South Africa have enough evidence to proceed with this case?
So there are two aspects. One is genocide, but the other is intent to commit genocide. So
great. Well, that's actually one aspect.
Right.
But we'll get to that. Let's cut to that. That's a great point. Let's go right to it. According to Israel, now Israel's defense in this whole thing, we'll start with Israel's defense. Israel says, hey, you know, we acted with the intention to defend ourselves, to terminate the threats against Israel and to rescue hostages. And thus, there is no genocidal intent. We don't have any genocidal intent. We're defending ourselves. So the court takes note of that. And Israel says the accusation of genocide is not just legally and factually incoherent, it is obscene. And there's no valid basis in fact or law for this outrageous charge of genocide. Well, what does the genocide statute say? What are they working from here? Genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent. So in other words, intent is built into genocide. If you say someone's guilty of genocide, you're saying they intended it. There's no negligent genocide. It's intentional.
Right.
So it includes a few things. And look, there's really kind of two things that are important. You intend to destroy in whole or in part not an army, but a national, ethical, racial, or religious group. Okay, that you're trying to kill, you know, massive amounts of people in a certain group, and there's things that qualify for it: killing members of the group, causing serious bodily harm to members of the group, you know, forcibly transferring children of the group. It's all about a group, and it's a non-military group, and that's really the focus for genocide. But as you point out, Israel's got to prove up intent.
Right.
And the court has to find intent, but they do find intent. So I want to cut to the opinion, like, how is the court? Because everybody will tell you, every lawyer, like, it's really hard to prove intent.
Yes, it is.
It is. It's hard to prove intent.
It's hard.
So let's go to the evidence that the court notes and says, here's the intent. And it's pretty compelling. And I've, by the way, I've excised a lot of pages here. I'm just focusing on the ones that are relevant and can get us through this quickly. But here's the proof. These are cabinet level officials and higher. You got the defense minister of Israel announcing that he had ordered a complete siege of Gaza City, not limited to soldiers or fighters, complete siege, and that there would be no electricity, no food, no fuel, and that everything was closed. Okay? And he says, I have released all restraints. You saw what we are fighting against. We are fighting human animals. Right? We will eliminate everything. If it doesn't take one day, it'll take a week, it'll take weeks or even months. We will reach all places. Okay? That's the defense minister. Let's go to the president. This is the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog. He says, it's an entire nation out there. Okay? That's the whole group. An entire nation that is responsible. Okay? They could have risen up. The whole nation could have risen up. They could have fought against the evil regime which took over Gaza in a coup d'etat, but they didn't, and so now we're coming to get them. We'll break their backbone, he says. Let's cut to another cabinet official, Israel Katz, Minister of Energy and Infrastructure. He says all the civilian population, okay, in Gaza is ordered to leave immediately. Okay, so get out of your homes. We will win. They will not receive a drop of water or a single battery until what? Until they leave the world, until they are dead. And the court says, yeah, that's intent. No question about that. And then they come down here and the court orders a series of remedies. You have to take immediate and effective measures to, you know, ensure basic services and humanitarian assistance. But I want to flag this one because in 30 days, Israel is going to have to provide a report on what it's done to comply with the order. In the meantime, Israel must take effective measures against to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence. Okay, don't go destroying evidence. That's a big no-no.
So, you know, I just have to stop you here because complying with that is very difficult. Complying with it, not only complying with it, but complying with it in such a way that you can document and prove that you complied. That's a very difficult thing to do, particularly in the circumstance Israel can do. And I will bet you the chances are very good that they will just blow that off.
I think the chances are pretty solid. I'll blow the entire thing off.
Right. I agree.
But I want to flag something here that if you read to the opinion, and I've got a link to the opinion. If you read to the opinion, I'm going to cut back to one last thing. But we're largely done with the opinion. If you read through it, you'll see that 15 of the 17 judges are on board with all of these things. And in one case, it was 16 of 17. The one exception was the judge from Sudan. And when it was 15, it was also the judge from Israel, an ad hoc judge. No surprise there. But even the Israel judge went with the court on a couple of things. It's astonishing.
That is astonishing.
But you might think, if you're like me, I was like, well, you know, maybe are the judges, it sounds like, you know, maybe there's no American judges on the panel. Mm-mm. Get this. Get a load of this. Signed by Joan Donahue, the president. Okay. So I looked up all these people. Joan Donahue is an American. She cut her teeth at the law firm of Covington & Burling. Do you remember
her
name? Yeah. She was GC, general counsel at Freddie Mac. So this is an American from, for sure, the American power structure.
Who's engaged in massive mortgage fraud.
Saying they're guilty of genocide. That South Africa has mustered a prima facie showing of genocide, and the case is going to go forward. And I'm telling you, the next thing, if I'm reading the kind of tea leaves out there, if I'm the U.S., I don't be surprised if you're next. If the next charge that comes from South Africa is you're complicit in the genocide.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, John, because I remember it was in 2004, I think, that the head of the Council of Foreign Relations wrote an excellent article about, and it was very sort of graciously done, saying the neocons are killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And, you know, they've got to stop or we're going to destroy everything. And, you know, that's my paraphrase of it. But essentially, the American establishment has known for a long time that the neocons are going to blow it. And it wouldn't surprise me if they've decided, okay, we're going to pull the rug out from under.
Wow. That would be a thing. The way I would phrase that isn't the goose and the golden egg. It's an expression I picked up in Chicago from commodity traders. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered.
Right.
Don't be a hog.
Right. Well, if you look at Charlie Ferguson's documentary on what happened in Iraq.
No end in sight.
Right. Basically, you've got the Council on Foreign Relation types, the moderate Republican types, basically, you know, pointing out that the neocons are nuts. And you wonder, okay, why haven't you guys been able to rein them in yet? You know, what's your problem?
That's a great question. And, you know, Paul Craig Roberts comes out of the Reagan administration. I think he was under assistant secretary. He says flat out the neocons are insane. These people are
insane.
They think they can win a nuclear war. You got to get these people out.
Well, they get pleasure from destroying things. You know, they think the way to change something is you go in and you wreck it, and then you work from there. And they like wrecking things. They're people who smash things and move on.
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't know why the establishment cannot figure out how to stop them. But, you know, the way they will be stopped is to, you know, you destroy the unipolar. I mean, the unipolar empire fails, and that ultimately will destroy them.
To me, the coup in the U.S. occurred a long time ago.
Right.
I mean, I would argue 2008. It was perpetrated and run by bankers. So start there. If you want to know why the neocons haven't been reined in, check with the bankers.
I would start in 98 because that's when the fraud that collapsed in 2008
started. Would you check the bankers?
What?
So you and I are 10 years off on the goalposts, but would you ascribe the coup to bankers?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Right. So we're on board there.
Right. So you've got a lethal combination of new invisible weaponry and control of the federal credit. And, you know, and the bankers absolutely are running it.
Yeah. To me, I go back to the goalposts set by Machiavelli and Jefferson. You know, Machiavelli says the army is the most powerful. That's what you really where you want to be. And Jefferson's like, no, bankers. In between was the creation of the central banks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why
so
the great
I told
minds
you,
don't
you
agree.
Know, the creation, the central banks created the bond market. And the bond market said you could start and finance a war, you know, before you had to pay for it. And then we were off to the races. So
Bank of England, you're off to the races, right?
You're off to the races.
Like, hey, war is great. We can gin up a lot of money and a lot of assets all at once. Isn't that wonderful?
Well, I sang last night, a guy in Norway did a little video saying conscription is coming to Europe, which to me is frightening. So that
is frightening, and we'll see. You know, as goes Europe, so goes the U.S. We'll see some indication of that here too.
Yep.
But in any case, let's keep it going with genocide Gaza within the immediate aftermath. So that was January 26th. That opinion. Get a load of this from Insider Paper. I don't really know this publication, but there's a lot of stories on this. UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees sacks employees for alleged October 7th role. So the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said Friday it had sacked several employees accused by the genocidal maniac Israel of involvement in Hamas's unprecedented October 7th attack, prompting the United States to suspend critical funding. So, you know, the UN, so the group here is the UN RWA. We'll get to them in a little bit, but it's a humanitarian outlet in the UN. We'll see another story on that in a minute. But the U.S. State Department said it was extremely troubled by the allegations from genocidal Israel and has temporarily paused additional funding while it reviewed the claims and the U.N. plan to address concern. So the U.S. response to being guilty of genocide by Israel is to cut off funding, thereby exacerbating the genocide. Why would they the U.S. do this? Because 12 employees might have been involved. Huh.
Right.
Way to double down on your own mistake.
So I got a long, right after the decision came out, I got a long email from a colleague in Israel who's Israeli, essentially claiming that Israel is entirely funding Hamas, and Hamas is basically an Israeli operation. I have no idea if that's true or not, but we've reached a point where I think anybody who looks at this factually doesn't believe a word coming out of the Israeli government. And that's the problem with having leaders like Netanyahu, because ultimately, you know, the lies work until they don't anymore. And I would suggest one of the reasons they're not working anymore is the U.S. military doesn't have the successful military presence to instill the fear they need in the Middle East. So,
And we're going to get to that too, Catherine. There's a story on that very point.
Right.
But I want to, so if nobody believes Israel, why is it the UN, which just said Israel's committing genocide, why would they then believe them now? And I think the reason is, like I said, the court there is pretty conservative. They're giving Israel credit. We'll assume everything you say is true, and we'll go from there. And I think the notion is, if Israel raises the concern, let's eliminate all dispute and let's give them what they want, so we avoid a later charge of tampering or of witness, you know, whatever, impropriety of witnesses or whatever. So the UN has planned it kind of safe here by sacking those employees. That's my read of that.
I don't know. I have no idea what the evidence was that they might have been involved.
You saw the story. There's nothing more than accusations.
Right.
In other words, the people were on the ground. They were witnessing the atrocities, and now they get fired. In other words, what's really going on is they're scuttling witnesses.
Well, that's what it looks like to me. It's knowledge management. They're deleting the databases, right?
Yeah, you got it. That's what's really going on.
Right.
But apparently, I think the UN thinks, it doesn't really matter. You're on the hook. You know, you're not getting out of this one. So we'll go ahead and, fire the employees. And this case is going forward anyway. We'll give you what you want.
So if you look at the lies that Israel has told so far, there used to be a time when they could lie and it was murky. People wouldn't spend the time to dig in and figure out what was going on, or it wasn't outrageous. But if you look at, we talked about, it was over a month ago, 68% of the housing in Gaza being destroyed.
Right.
You know, that's so blatantly, not dealing as an army with Hamas. That is eradicating.
You could infer intent just from the numbers.
Right. Exactly.
But the cabinet officials and the president himself, talk about leading with your chin and making those statements. Are you out of your mind, those statements?
Well, but they've been used to getting away with murder for a long time.
And so, bragging about mass slaughter. It's what they're doing.
Right. And so I don't know. They're not changing their, they're not changing their costume for this time around. But this time around is different. And
it's different. Exactly. You got it. Right. There's a court now.
Well, but here's the thing: the court came out in a context where, if you look at what has happened at the UN, the majority of countries in the world are against Israel on this one. So Israel and the United States have surprisingly little support, sort of given the money they throw around and the power they throw around. And now the court has come out, and it's very interesting that the court has come out, with a Covington and Burling attorney at the top.
Can you believe that? I mean, she was a young associate when she was there, but still. GC at Fannie Mae, that's a real position.
So I can't tell you how many people I know who've had it with the dual passport game going on in the Congress and the White House. They've had it.
I think you're right. The question I got at this point is, does the U.S. have, you remember Falling Down with Michael Douglas going on a rampage? Does the U.S. have its falling down moment where Michael Douglas pauses and goes, wait a minute, I'm the bad guy?
Right.
Does that happen over here? Does the U.S. say, we can't go along with this? Now that we have the court opinion, we can no longer fund the genocide. Sorry.
So my experience with the dual, you know, sort of the whole dual passport crew in Washington, and, you know, or let's call it the neocons, because it's a certain number of conservatives plus the dual passport plus Israel.
Right, right.
They don't know how to be judicious. They just double down.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So there's a double down psychology that's out of control. And I don't think, you know, they have to literally hit a wall. And they haven't hit a wall until they've wrecked the whole planet.
I think you're right. I think it's the same old, same old. And you've already seen indications of it in that previous story. It's like, well, we're going to go along with Israel no matter what. They made some allegations, so we're going to cut funding, exacerbate the genocide.
So I get back to the pushback. The pushback are millions and millions of people receding and pulling back. So, you know, the old sort of adage about the herd, and the herd just starts moving away from the diseased animal, but they do it very steadily and quietly. They're just moving. So the neocons are the diseased animal, and the herd's just moving away. And they're moving their money, they're moving their time, they're moving their association. So, you know, we're going to go through this. It's what you and I called the bifurcation the last time we talked. We're going to go through this bifurcation, and it's going to be ugly. It's ugly now. It's getting uglier.
It is going to be painful, too.
Right.
You know. Okay.
I've been in the States for essentially, you know, a week or two. And I can't tell you, you know, Ed Dowd said 30% of the workforce was disabled or dead, I think. But I can't tell you how many meetings or dinners or other things we're doing that are impacted. You know, somebody can't show up because their plane broke down. Somebody can't show up because, you know, their wife got sick. Somebody can't show up because the car broke down. And you're just feeling the, you know, the implosion that happens when you have a slow moving genocide. Because, you know, the genocide is far wider than just Gaza.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. The poison, the root fundamental poison is way, way deeper than just over in the Middle East, not isolated in the Middle East at all.
Right, right.
You're talking about way more fundamental causes, and you're exactly right. I think they're expressing themselves all over the place.
Well, I'll bet you the Pfizer rollout in Israel killed more people than have been killed so far in Palestine. I don't know that, but that's just a wild guess.
I wouldn't take that action.
Oh, anyway, I know, because you're always waiting for evidence. I'm an investment banker. I'm always looking to trade.
You're an investment banker. You know what? This is kind of the, you're a gambler, is what you are.
No. If you're, you know, here's the problem. If you're sitting on a trading floor, you've got a position. You're long. You've got a position. So you got to, you know, you got to keep hold the position, which is an action, or you got to sell the position, or hedge the position. You're in, and you have, you know, you have 5% knowledge, and you can't wait.
Right. You can't wait. You've got to.
It's a different attitude.
5% knowledge, but you've got a potential 50 times gain. I get it. That's a bet.
Right.
You know, that's the whole thing with kind of value investing.
But that's why, as you notice, I always try to surround myself with great lawyers. We're like, wait.
Yeah, right. Hold on, Fitz. Let's rein it in there for a second. Okay, but anyway, in any case, the pretend is over. So, you know, this is a big, don't underestimate the effect of this opinion. The whole fantasy, the whole Disney character of the U.S. riding the white horse and knight in shining army, saving the world, the good guy and all, that's gone, and it's gone forever. You're the bad guy now. You've replaced. You're on your way to replacing Nazi Germany with a genocide like this. This is not. This is going to leave a mark, and the rest of the world is looking at it. And you said millions of people. I'd say it's really probably billions of people.
Yes, billions of people. So here's the question: if you look at, you know, so we have elections all around the world, and of course we have an election in the United States. if you look at all three candidates for president, they're all on the wrong side of this. All three of them.
That's unbelievable. Yep. Back to the bankers. Okay, let's keep it going with FedWatch. Continuing the theme of, you know, the destruction of a population. Keep your eye on this one. This is a story from a publication, I don't know, but fizz.org. Food from urban agriculture has carbon footprint 6 times larger than conventional produce, study shows. So those home gardens are a menace in cities. A new University of Michigan-led international study finds that fruits and vegetables grown in urban farms and gardens have a carbon footprint that is, on average, 6 times greater than conventionally grown produce. You've got to be kidding me. Urban agricultural practitioners can reduce their climate impacts, so how do they fix this problem? By cultivating crops that are typically greenhouse grown or air freighted, in addition to making changes in site design and management, said a study co-led by author Jafin Hawes. In other words, we need to start meddling in these dangerous greenhouse gardens growing food.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. You know, the Victory Gardens produce 40% of the fruits and vegetables in the United States at their height.
And, wow.
And gardens, particularly urban gardens, can produce a huge amount of food. So if you're going to control the food supply, you've got to play this game.
Yeah, it's a climate game. So now we're starting to see like one of the, why are they on about this climate? This just complete
This is a banker money game because you cannot get complete control of financial transactions unless you control food.
It's a banker money game. Which brings us to our very next story on the very same topic from American Stewards of Liberty, the attack on farmers and ranchers that no one is talking about. The Department of Agriculture, without congressional approval, announced they were spending $3.1 billion to implement partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities Project. So who gets the money? Well, $90 million to Archer Daniel Midland and other major partners include every major company in the food business from Cargill to Costco. But the author says the most disgusting payment of all was $40 million to the largest ag media corporation, Farm Journal. Why would the government pay a media company $40 million to implement an environmental program? Control the messenger, control the message, a.k.a. state-run media. The intended goal for the Climate Smart Project is to, here we go again, manipulate farmers and ranchers into calculating greenhouse gas emissions, or what they call implementation and monitoring of climate smart practices, so those emissions can then be regulated and we can regulate what you grow, tell you what to grow.
Right. And they're using taxpayers' money to do this. It's pretty... So we're going to have Margaret Byfield back on Financial Rebellion this week to talk about conservation easements. So the NACs got stopped and canceled, but they're coming back around. And they're coming back around with a tsunami of ways of buying up and controlling the farmland. I just met with a legislator here in Tennessee who said the governor of Tennessee has now met with Bill Gates 7 times. Of course, Bill Gates is now the number one owner of farmland in America and just keeps buying. So the game is on to control and own the farmland. And where you can't get them off, you know, where they won't sell out, you've got all these different games to end up taking control. And if you can, we're going to be talking about conservation easements, but if you can get them to do an easement for financial reasons, and then you come in behind and use that easement to manipulate or control, it's a very dirty game. And you know, one of my favorite TV shows is Yellowstone, and the Yellowstone story is, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a land grab.
As we're going to see later, though, agriculture and farmers, that's a dangerous sandbox for the powers that be to be meddling in. That is a tinderbox looking for a flame, and we're going to see a story on that. I mean, you're playing with fire, guys.
Yep.
You're going to get burned on this one. It's a matter of time.
I hope.
Yep. In the meantime, let's continue with FedWatch. And just here's another story. This is, you know, another sop to the banks. Big surprise, but here you go. Whatever the Fed does, it's doing for the banks, not for you. Wolf Street, effective immediately, Fed shuts down arbitrage opportunity with the bank term funding program. So this is another giveaway to the banks. The arbitrage opportunity, you can read that as giveaway. Here we go.
The whole federal credit is an arbitrage opportunity that's been going on my entire life. I just want to point that out.
This one is just straight giveaway, straight usury. It's incredible. So what went on here? So you had to panic back in March, almost a year ago, with the Silicon Valley Bank and the bank failures, three bank failures. And so the Fed starts the Bank Term Funding Program, but now they're going to cease making new loans as scheduled on March 11th. Okay, so this funding program had a fatal flaw. Under certain conditions, the interest rate that the Fed charges on loans at this new window, this new facility, could fall substantially below the interest rate that the Fed pays on reserve balances. So the bank accounts that the banks hold at the Fed. So what would happen? So what ended up happening is starting in early November, the rate did fall below during the rate cut mania, okay? And it opened up a riotous risk-free arbitrage opportunity that banks took advantage of. In other words, the interest rate so the banks would borrow from this funding facility at say 0.5%, and then they turn around and take the money they just borrowed from the Fed and they'd park it back in their Fed bank account and earn 1%.
Right.
A free money machine, free money supply.
Right. And it's one of the reasons the Fed is announcing a loss. Because it's just a dividend. It's a straight shot into the guys who own the bank.
And who's on the hook for the loss? Is it the banks themselves that we're gonna tag the bank?
What the loss does is, you know, so the profit of the Fed is supposed to be turned over to the Treasury, and so what it does is it just siphons off the profit. It's the same game we saw in the mortgage funds at the U.S. government. You know, the single family was supposed to be a mutual, but they had all these games to claw the money out the back door, and it was just a steal from the guys who were supposed to get the profit.
It's just a straight steal. It's just a straight up steal.
Well, here's the thing. I remember when I left FHA, so I stopped being Assistant Secretary of Housing and I just left HUD, and I was having lunch with one of the biggest, with the head of the Washington area office of one of the biggest banks in the country. And I looked at their balance sheet that morning and I realized they were borrowing from the, they were borrowing for Treasury short and they were reinvesting in Treasury long, and they were making a $6 billion a year. You know, they're just printing. They're just printing a profit.
Right,
and I sat down at lunch and the guy said, why should we loan money to businesses in the DC area? It's not a good business. We can make more in the markets. And I said, well, wait a minute, you're raising all this money. So I pulled out his balance sheet. I said, you're raising all this money using our credit, the federal credit, and you're raising it, including our deposits. So you're scarfing up all the deposits in the DC area using our credit, backing the insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And then you're taking the money and you're lending it back to Treasury long, you know, and we don't need you to do that. We could just do that directly. We don't need you to be in the middle of that to get $6 billion a year to do that.
What are you adding to this exactly? Right. Your role in this transaction?
And on each side, we, the taxpayers, guarantee you, and we're printing you $6 billion a year for which you take no risk and do nothing.
Right.
And you're saying you won't loan our money back to us? What do we need you for? And so he looked at me, and the next week they announced a $10 billion lending program in this area. Now, do I think they really did $10 billion? Probably not, but it was a good headline. But, you know, he had literally forgotten that he was just arbitraging the federal credit, and it was a printing machine, printing profits for which they did nothing, took no risk. And frankly, we don't need them to do it, just like we don't need $35 trillion of debt because we could have just issued greenbacks, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
Right. But and then you'll have officials stand up and say, well, that is curious that the program ended up like that, harming businesses. You know, well, God, well, we didn't see that. These people have been paid their entire careers to spot money-generating opportunities exactly like that, and then they'll turn around and pretend, oh, we didn't see that.
I heard the other night, I haven't gone to confirm it, but somebody announced, JP Morgan Chase just announced record earnings, $50 billion. This is how they make $50 billion.
Surprise. Yeah. They took it out of your pocket. Isn't that great? That's how they made $50 billion. They're really smart. Okay.
No.
Let's keep it going. This next story, kind of wolf in sheep's clothing. Beware. This is from Governor Greg Abbott of Texas. And he's complaining about the border, and he's got good grounds to complain about the border. No question about that. But there's a fly in the ointment here. Under President Biden's lawless border policies, More than 6 million illegal immigrants have crossed our southern border in just 3 years. Okay, that's a great point. However, you did mention 3 years. That's a long time. What have you done about that? Have you, your attorney general, sued the federal government? And then he says, that is why the framers, you know, we got to defend our border, included Article 4, Section 4, which says the federal government shall protect each state against invasion, and Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, which acknowledges the state's sovereign interest in protecting their borders. And then he cites this case, United States versus Arizona, but he cites the dissenting opinion. Okay? That is called leading with your chin. And he goes on and says, okay, for these reasons, I have unilaterally declared an invasion to invoke Texas's constitutional authority to defend and protect itself. That authority is the supreme law of the land, even though he didn't bring a lawsuit or anything else. That's unbelievable that this guy's like, oh, I'm going to unilaterally declare the right to defend the borders with, from an invasion, right, having said, I haven't done anything for 3 years in the courts. And by the way, our authority to do this is coming from the dissent. I cut my teeth at a law firm where, as a first-year associate, you get one warning for citing a dissenting opinion.
Right.
And then the next time you do it, you're out the door.
Right.
For him to do that is just absolutely, I was gobsmacked when I read that. And to announce it, it's the dissent I'm citing.
Right. So the whole thing makes no sense.
It's unbelievable.
Because if you look at what is actually going on in the border, you know, what I keep being sent by different people in Texas. One guy said, you know, this is not like the Middle East. We have lots of family and friends on the border in Texas, or people in Texas who know people on the border. And if you look at what's going on in the border, you know, whatever the invasion is, it's just open and continuing.
Yeah.
So right. This is theater, as far as I can tell. And we got...
And it's dangerous.
Yeah, it is dangerous. It is dangerous because I can't tell you how many people here in Tennessee I've run into who believe they're, you know, that Texas is really standing up. But if you look at what is going on the border, they're not really standing up. So, you know, you wonder what in the world is Abbott up to? What's the game here? And I don't know. You know, everybody's saying, okay, now he's running for VP. But it's, I got one message I sent you from a rancher. And the message was, we're not going on this convoy that's going south. They think it's another January 6th setup.
The aroma of honey, as in honey trap, coming off of that missive from Governor Abbott is overwhelming.
You know, it's we've reached the point where we cannot trust anything in the media. So
and high-ranking officials, you know, pay extra special attention to them.
Well,
especially ones with political ambitions.
What I'm really grateful for is if you look at all the people from the Solari Report, the subscribers in the network, who post comments and information and send us all sorts of information about what they're seeing on the ground. I really believe, you know, we know too many people in Texas to fall for these things. And that's why the more we can be an intelligence network for each other, you know, that is where the best intelligence is coming from. Because the world is complex, but it's also real. And what we're seeing in the media is just not real.
Yeah, and one of those reports said, this is what opened my eyes, was a lot of the hotels and motels along the areas in Texas in question are overwhelmingly filled with law enforcement officers of all stripes.
Right.
It's like,
right.
Oh, really? Stay away.
Right.
Yeah. That's okay. Not a good look, Abbott. Anyway. Yeah, you know, if you really wanted to do something, get after him in court. You said yourself this has been going on for 3 years. Do something about it,
right,
other than
right,
declaring yourself king and commissioning your own army. Are you out of your mind?
Well, but if you're king and you commission your own army, you need to close off the roads between across. I don't know. You know, the reports I get is there's not a lot of enforcement. But I'll just say anybody who's in Texas or close to the border, you know, keep sending your reports.
Absolutely. Very, 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 very helpful. Seeing right. That was like a big time tip off
right.
The hotel situation.
Right.
Okay. You mentioned January 6th. And a lot of people will tell you that was a coup or that was an insurrection. Let's go to a lawyer's
state. That was an op. And You know, it was funny because I said it wasn't out from a month before it started. So, I, you know, as soon as they announced every and tried to get everybody, they were using major entrainment and tricks and propaganda to get people to go to Washington.
Oh, for sure.
And you know, I said it was an op all the way along. And one of the reasons we haven't spent much time covering it on the Saleri Report is, you know, the before, the during, and the after, it's all an op.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I hate to say it, it's a terrible waste of time other than trying to get the innocent parties who've been thrown in prison out of prison.
But let's take the ICJ approach to this and assume that everything in the story is true. Give them credit for everything in the story. Even if we accept all of your proffered facts as true, the question still remains, is that really a coup d'etat? Is it really an insurrection? And I want to cut to a clip here of a lawyer named Glenn Greenwald on the left discussing whether or not this is an insurrection. All right, here we go. This is part of a debate that was held recently.
Was this an attempted coup? Do you guys think this was an attempted coup?
No. Of course it was. Obviously it was.
An attempted coup. What is that if not a coup? Coup or an insurrection? Attempted coup. It's an attempted coup. A coup. It's a coup. Definition of a coup. Definition of a coup.
If this were a coup, why didn't Trump order the military to seize control of power and turn over the election process to him? Why didn't he order the armed factions that form the law enforcement part of the military and the executive branch that serve under his command to do that as well? That's what happens in a coup. That didn't happen here because Trump wasn't trying to perpetrate a coup. On top of that, none of the videotapes that were available was made available to the public except for very deceitfully chosen snippets. And it was only within the last several months that we saw all of the video footage. And what it showed makes a joke of the idea that this was a coup. If he had ordered the military or some other FBI or any of those agencies, the CIA, to go and use violence on domestic soil in order to ignore those court rulings the way people do when they're trying to implement coups, you would have a good argument. He didn't do any of that. He invoked all of his legal rights in the judiciary and in the Congress. He lost and he walked out of the White House on January 20th. He did not have to be dragged out. He wasn't arrested by the military, which is what happens in coups. So much of this is because you only started paying attention to politics in 2016. You only live in the United States. You have no idea about history or anything that happens in other countries. You have no idea what a coup is. And the reason it matters, Destiny, is because if you're going to make arguments, there has to be an important test, which is, do you apply the same principles you're claiming to profess and believe in to cases where it undermines your partisan allegiance and your ideology, not only where it helps it? That's one of the key tests for determining the authenticity of your argument. And so if you don't think the 2020 protest movement was an insurrectionary movement against the United States government, there's no way to claim what January 6th was. Especially since Trump could have done so much more to cause a coup that he did not do because that wasn't his aim ever.
Oh, my neck!
You got knocked the fuck out, man!
You rarely run one that long, so. But he does a great job of walking you through what a real coup looks like and how it works versus the completely ridiculous.
Right. The key thing is he tried to exercise his legal rights. He went to court. He went to Congress. And when he lost, he walked out on January 21st. End of story.
Right.
That's it. That's not even colorable as a coup. And yet we've gone on for now 3-4 years with this endless drumbeat of, oh, a violent insurrection, all the rest. And nobody believes it. I mean, just look at the polls. If anybody believed that, Trump wouldn't be, you know, within spitting distance of the White House. And yet here he is. He's the odds-on favorite if you check the bookmakers.
So you know the story of the, you know, of the child who calls wolf. And you've got a problem here because whether it's Netanyahu or the Biden administration or, you know, we're going to look at a chart later from Statista that sort of shows the extent to which opinion of national politicians have fallen. And we're coming into a period where very dangerous things can go wrong. And there needs to be high trust and communication between leadership and population. And we don't have that because essentially the credibility of the national leaderships has been destroyed in all the ways we've talked about. I mean, if Netanyahu, if something seriously dangerous happened Netanyahu needed to communicate. I don't think there's a person in the world that believe a word he says.
Well, there's not a person in the world outside of the State Department or the U.S. government who would believe what he's.
No, they wouldn't believe what it said. They pretend they believe what he said.
Pretend but they right.
They don't believe what he says.
Fair enough.
He's a liar. Right.
Fair enough. Yeah.
A lot of things can go wrong when nobody trusts anybody.
It's not just the credibility of politicians that's taking the hit. Now, as we move into space military global turf wars, it's the credibility of the U.S. military that's taking the hit, too.
Right.
And we're going to see that big time in this next story. And this is, by the way, you know, this touches back on, we've covered stories like this where a country makes a long-term deal with Russia, a long-term energy deal. Like that's a pretty hefty bet. If you're making a 20-year deal with Russia, you're confident in something.
Right.
To ink a deal like that, especially this next one. Let's take a look at this. This is from oilprice.com, the long article. But Russia and Iran finalized 20-year deal that will change the Middle East forever. So the Ayatollah gave his official approval to a 20-year comprehensive cooperation deal between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Russia. Okay, it's going to replace the 10-year deal signed in March of 2001. It has been expanded not only in duration, but in scope and scale, particularly in a defense and energy sector. So it's not just energy, it's defense. And that's what makes this interesting. The new deal gives Russia, it's a sweetheart deal for Russia, apparently, if you look at this. The new deal gives Russia the right of first extraction in the Iranian section of the Caspian Sea, including the potentially huge Chalice Field, the wider Caspian Basin areas, including both onshore and offshore fields, is conservatively estimated to have around $48 billion of oil and 292 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in proven and provable reserves. So this isn't some speculation. This is like, here, have this oil, have this gas. The price of all manufactured items, this is a separate part of the deal, traded between Russia and Iran, including military, so again, it's not just energy, and energy hardware, has been formalized in the new deal, although not in Iran's favor. For Iranian goods exported to Russia, Tehran will receive the cost of production plus 8%. Not very much. So why ink this? Why do this, Iran? What all this means is the new 20-year deal between Iran and Russia will change the landscape of the Middle East, Southern Europe, and Asia, as Iran will have a much extended military reach. It will give it much more leverage to make political demands across those regions. This reach also means that countries in these areas will feel that continuing to rely on the U.S. for their protection is a lot more of a precarious option than it was before. Wow. So Iran's banking on Russia's military superiority over the U.S. for the next 20 years.
Right. So I do think the U.S. has really hurt itself in terms of its image of its military performance in the Middle East. And that's...
And in Ukraine.
Yes, that's a dangerous situation. But again and again, what we're seeing is Africa long-term deals with Russia, the Middle East or Iran now long-term deal with Russia. And this is the advantage of being seen as being agreement capable.
Yeah.
So the U.S., the message from the Middle Eastern sort of military performance and the Ukraine performance is America is not agreement capable. It just keeps coming back to America doesn't keep its agreements. It doesn't make and keep deals. And now we're seeing countries around the world making long-term deals with Russia, who is much less. I mean, if you look at their economic power, it's significantly less than the United States, but they are viewed as being agreement capable. And there is no doubt that they've done a remarkable job since the Soviet Union came down and Putin took control to rebuild their military. So,
yeah. And by the way, the $100 billion of gear and equipment that they gave to Ukraine, that's not worth that much. Now the average age of the Ukrainian army is 43. So it's propping up a haggard straw man that's on his last gasp of
breath. They've exported or slaughtered all the young men.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Speaking of genocide.
So, and we've covered stories of Patriot missiles being sniffed out by Russia and just pounded into the sand again and again.
Right.
Plane is not working. Just tanks. Not working. Just a joke.
Right.
The U.S. is no longer the pretend is over. Your role as the global Superman That's a bygone era.
The pretend is over, but if you look at the military hardware and power that the U.S., they can still do a lot of damage.
For sure.
Right.
And you'll notice that Russia isn't making any sudden moves. It's all very gradual. They're content to let Ukraine bleed out and let events kind of run their course naturally. A war of attrition at this point favors the larger dominant party, and that party is Russia.
Right. Or BlackRock.
no sudden moves. BlackRock sniffing around over there too. But that's a story for another day. A story for today is Lloyd Austin.
Yep.
Remember last time? It's like, yep. Well, where's Lloyd?
Where's Lloyd?
Lloyd's out of the hospital. So Lloyd shows up on C-SPAN this week. He meets Stoltenberg of NATO. And here there's a clip. I just want to run this clip and listen to what Lloyd has to say. Here we go. There's Lloyd on the right and Stoltenberg on the left across from him.
We've made excellent progress on implementing the decisions that our leaders made at the Vilnius. With our approved regional plans, we're ensuring a theater-wide, multi-domain deterrent. And if any adversary challenges that deterrent, the alliance is ready to fight and to win. So I look forward to some frank discussions with you and our valued allies about what we need to strengthen our collective deterrence and defense. And that includes reaching and maintaining the levels of defense spending and production that we need to follow through on our commitments from Vilnius. That's vital so that we can continue to support Ukraine and to replenish our own stocks of weapons and munitions.
So he says basically, we need to spend more money. And one of the reasons we need to spend more money in the alliance here with NATO is we need to replenish our stocks. So we spent hundreds of billions of dollars in Ukraine, and we're going to double down because now we're out of stuff. We need to replenish our stocks.
So how much of that money went to the Ukraine, and how much went to the weapon manufacturers, and how many of those weapons went to the Ukraine?
Yeah, so, good question.
Right. So there's never been any financially meaningful report of how that money really worked and where it really went. All we know is all sorts of shipments around the world of weapons supposedly going to the Ukraine that were going someplace else.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I wonder if this isn't a straight shot into Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed.
It begs the question, that question you raised, like how much of the money went over there? So which of two choices, what is it? Big Five, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Boeing, you know, you guys. Which of two things is true? Either you stole a lot of money or your stuff doesn't work because Ukraine's getting pounded. Average age of the army is 43. What's up? And Lloyd's answer is, well, we need to spend even more money on these guys.
Well, here was when I was in Washington, what was happening in the military is that the budgets weren't being driven by what would make an effective military force. The budgets were driven by what purchases could drive the stocks of the big weapons manufacturers and the big contractors.
Right.
So it was a private profit acquisition game, and the whole budget and planning for the military was turned upside down. So you weren't trying to deliver an effective fighting force. You were delivering purchases for publicly traded companies.
Right. So, the purpose of the U.S. Army is to enrich shareholders, and the purpose of the Russian Army is to win landmass wars. And guess what? Both militaries are winning on those objectives.
Right. Well, it wasn't just to generate profits for publicly traded companies. It was to get those publicly traded companies to hire up a lot of talent and keep them busy so they wouldn't be part of the pushback team. No, really.
Yeah.
And spread that employment in congressional districts so that the congressional districts would all play games. So it was very politically driven. And that's, if you look at the economics of the Russian military versus the U.S. military, the U.S. military is carrying an extraordinary load of non-military expenses. I would say the majority of the military expenses are non-military expenses.
Give me an example of a line item that you would classify as a non-military expense.
Oh, spending money on, you know, building new ships as opposed to fielding an army that can really perform in the field. So spending money on things as opposed to spending money on training and personnel that can really, you know, fight in the field. So you're spending money on stuff instead of people, right?
Or they're spending money on training that has nothing to do with military purposes.
Right, right.
Like like inclusion training and
Oh, please.
Because you know that's expensive. They're hiring highly paid people to run those.
It's expensive. It's expensive to do it, but the greatest expense is it's an anti-recruitment advertising campaign. The people you want to come and sign up will no longer come and sign up. So it's back to having an effective, you know, the difference between the Russians and the Americans is the extent to which the Russians can put men in the field who can fight.
Right.
So we still, you know, we're now talking in the Ukraine, we're talking about a land war. You need an army.
And the U.S. is not a landmass army.
Right. And neither is NATO. And the danger is the Europeans are going to, you know, I sent you that video last night on conscription, some guy in Norway talking about how he thought they were going to, NATO was going to start doing conscription. And that's a danger because if they need a land war and try and put a land war, a land fighting force together, they can destroy the European society.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And we've talked about this before too. It's been a while for the U.S. I mean, Operation Desert Storm was an unqualified success. That was 30 years ago, and B, that wasn't a peer adversary at all. When's the last time the U.S. faced a peer adversary?
No, generally we fight guys in sandals.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And now we're not fighting guys in sandals, even though we're back in Ukraine all the way, and it's not going well.
Right.
You know, and you've got Lloyd here saying, well, we need to spend more money. We need to enrich the shareholders.
Money can't solve this problem.
No. Exactly.
Money cannot solve the problem of a society that no longer has the glue that holds it together.
You got it.
Who,
it's a big problem.
No one wants to go fight for the dual citizen passport, guys.
No. Nobody wants to go. We saw that in a previous episode of Money Markets, too. It's the recruitment's way down.
Right.
The targets are way off. And essentially, you got now the Pentagon's having to bribe people to be pilots. Yeah, I mean, they're offering huge bonuses.
Do you have any idea of... Because remember, you have a concentration in the seven southern states of people going into the army. Once they did what they've done, if you look at the different things they've done to their soldiers with the anthrax vaccine or the COVID injection or all these different things they've done to poison and kill their own soldiers, you know, those families are talking. That message is moving out virally. And the damage that has been done over the last 3 years is... You know, I guess they think they can bring people in through the border and build a foreign army. I don't know what their plans to do, but
that's a good question. And you mentioned Southern soldiers. Let's go to our next story that allegedly occurred in Jordan, but we'll see. This is from CBS News. Pentagon releases names of three soldiers killed in drone attack in Jordan. Okay, well, what do we have? The Defense Department said, Sergeant Rivers of Georgia, Sanders of Georgia, and Moffitt of Georgia died on January 28th. The attack occurred when a one-way unmanned aerial system impacted their container housing units, the Pentagon said. Pentagon goes on and says the attack had the footprints of Hezbollah. Supposedly that occurred in Jordan. Let me cut to the map and show you this. There's where it supposedly occurred was in Jordan. However, Jordan itself says, and CBS doesn't bother to quote this, Jordan says, there's nothing happened. I don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing occurred within our border. And other people are like, just because it occurred, the attack didn't occur in Jordan. It occurred here where the U.S. trains ISIS, among other terrorist organizations.
That's Syria?
What happened. In Syria. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happened in Syria where the U.S. is parked illegally. They got an illegal base over there and they're training terrorist forces illegally. That's where the attack occurred. But you're not going to own up to it.
One of the problems they have is you're seeing, if you look at what a drone can do, and the economics of a drone, and you're trying to stop drones with million-dollar missiles and million-dollar surveillance systems, the economics are not working. So,
yeah.
Right.
Right, because you can have a $2,000 system go up against a $2 million system.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's, talk about asymmetrical warfare, and that's really what's going on. The other part of the story is you just get used to seeing, you know, now that the game is on in Israel and in Ukraine, and the U.S. is getting more and more involved and getting sucked into these wars and these battles, you're going to see more dead bodies. Remember, we already had, finally, the Navy confessed up the dead SEALs. Like, oh, they're missing for days, and they're finally like, yeah, they're presumed dead.
So let me go back to the dynamics. You have neocons who are crazy. You have a group of people who are leading this, who, you know, are described as we've discussed them, but they're not the kind of people who inspire, you know, people to walk into the fire for them.
No, right.
And so you've got a leadership that lacks, you know, the general population lacks confidence in them. So you have leaders who don't inspire support. And they've pushed the limit of sort of their crime that pays, crime that stays. And you've got economics that don't work. And the economics depend on financing that's coming from around the world. And so the people providing the financing have no confidence that these guys can deliver or win. Right. And that is a formula for the herd to move away from the diseased animal. And that's why this is getting phenomenally dangerous.
Right, but moving away, again, no sudden moves.
Right.
Not with the crazy neocons. No sudden moves.
No sudden moves.
They think there are people there who think they can win a nuclear war in that batch of people, neocons. Right.
But we're watching, the great pushback is we are watching their legs getting sawed out from under them all across the board.
Yeah, with things like 20-year deals between Iran and Russia, because Russia's going to provide the military muscle. And Iran's going to give them basically free gas and oil.
Right. Right.
In exchange, because it's not free.
Russia's success is not going to help the American people.
Absolutely, it's not going to help. No.
Right.
Right. We're losing status fast.
Right.
But it's steadily. It's just like this inexorable decline is on the way.
Right.
You know, it's here. It's
and that's why
right
what Abbott is doing is so depressing, because we need the states. If we're going to create conditions of sovereignty, we need the states. And we don't need the states playing in on
the Fed game.
Right.
Don't play the Fed game. We need smart local resistance.
Right.
You know. Okay. Let's keep it going with, well, there's one story in Hey Robot this week, kind of a, it's an electronic money story. Let's just click to it. It's from the Squawk Box. Exclusive banks. Bank locks customer's account after donation to, here we go, I'll see this group again, the UN, what is this, they say it here, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. So it's a humanitarian aid arm of the UN. And the customer's account, they subjected her to a security grilling minutes after she made a donation to UNRWA. So this got on the radar, and UNRWA was, it was a flag because they were providing a lifeline to suffering Palestinians in Gaza. And they quote the woman. She says, this is unbelievable. I've been with my bank for at least 20 years. Today, 2 minutes after donating a fiver, so £5 to UNRWA, I received a security call and they blocked my card. I can't get into my account at all. So again, doubling down on genocide.
One of the things, so I'm in Tennessee, and I've spent the last 2 days talking to wonderful Tennessee legislators. One of the things you see, because you've got leaders who are really trying to deal with this, but the idea that the banking system should have this much control is so overwhelming to people that they're almost afraid to look at it or talk about it. And you know, we have to look at it and we have to talk about it, because these guys are planning to assert 100% control of everything through the digital systems. And there are solutions. We don't have to go along. But it's pretty frightening. And I'm watching people as we show them the different information and videos. And the great thing about, you know, the great thing about some of the CBDC shorts that we've cut out, you know, the best one, of course, being the one you cut out of Karsten's at the IMF panel, you know, they're telling you what they're going to do. They're telling you they're going to do this. They're telling
Karsten's not even bothering to mask his glee over the control he's going to
have. Complete control.
We have complete control. The technology gives us complete control.
We don't have to go along, but you have to face it. And you have to start dealing with it. So, yeah.
Okay, let's shift gears. You know, again, continuing on with the kind of genocidal maniac theme, let's move on into Farmageddon. And our first story comes courtesy of the CDC from Zero Hedge. Email reveals why CDC did not issue an alert on COVID vaccines and myocarditis. Huh. Please tell us more. The CDC, in 2021, drafted an alert for heart inflammation or myocarditis for both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines. The alert would have been sent through CDC's Health Alert System, HAN, network, which goes to state and local officials as well as doctors across the country, but it was never sent. In May 25, 2021 email, exclusively attained by the Epoch Times, a CDC official revealed by some officials were against sending the alert. Quote, the pros and cons of an official HAN are what the main discussion are right now, said Dr. Sarah Oliver, the official wrote in an email. She says people don't want to appear to they don't want to appear to be alarmists with this, so we're not going to send it. Okay, what's the punchline here? Well, as it turns out, she was talking to, she was corresponding with an employee of either Pfizer or Moderna. You don't know because the names were redacted in the copy, but it was either Pfizer or Moderna. So in other words, the CDC, it's like, well, would you send this alert out? And they send an email to Pfizer, Moderna, and surprise, the alert doesn't go out. Okay. But that's not the worst part of it. The worst part of it is down farther when you get to Walensky's role in this. Here you go. Walensky, the CDC's director at the time, first addressed the issue of myocarditis in public in April 2021. She falsely said the agency had seen no reports and that no signal had been triggered. That was false. That was April 2021 when she said that. But again, this is back in May of 2021. The officials are talking about, they're so concerned about the reports coming out of myocarditis that they're talking about sending out an alert. And you got Walensky saying, well, no, we've seen nothing. No sign of trouble.
So I periodically have fantasies where I sit down over lunch with Walensky, take out a piece of paper and a pencil and say, let's calculate how many people you personally murdered.
Yeah.
How many people did you kill? How many women are now infertile because of you? Let's just do a calculation of how many.
Because of your lies.
What?
Because of your suppression of information and your material lies to people's faces.
Right.
In front of a microphone.
I pray that some group of attorneys can figure out how to go after her personally. That would be heaven.
Yeah.
That would be heaven to see her stripped of everything.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that, but I wouldn't bet against it either, given the activism we're starting to see in the courts.
Right.
And it's been slowly building.
She knew, you know, you can kill with a pen. You can kill with a press release. And she knew people were going to die.
Yeah.
And she lied.
We're going to suppress information about potentially fatal disease because we don't want to appear alarmist to who?
Right.
To Pfizer and Moderna, to the people profiting from this killing machine. Unbelievable.
Well, I would say it differently. I think Pfizer and Moderna were anointed by Operation Warp Speed and DOD to kill people. And, you know, it was the same problem with the riots. If you hire a contractor to go out and seed riots, it's going to affect their scope of work and pricing if you also send out military to stop them, right? So if you anoint Pfizer and Moderna to go, you know, run a depopulation machinery or a poisoning machinery, then the last thing you can afford to do, given their scope of work, is to create more risk, making it harder for them to do what you've asked them to do. So, you know, there's a legitimate reason why Pfizer and Moderna would get upset because their pricing was based on the CDC playing ball and being helpful as opposed to trying to stop them, right?
Well, they already had immunity deals from the government.
Right. Right, but they also have to manage employees, and if employees know that they're engineering a genocide program, they might take offense, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would love to see the real names off those emails. They were redacted.
Oh, me too.
You know,
me too.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. Okay, let's keep it going in Farmageddon. I love this next story because, you know, we get a lot of stories about what's going on in the WHO. And it's like, wait a minute, let's take a step back. What are we doing in the WHO? And here we go from Shabnam Mohammed, who we've seen before on Money Markets. Lawyers say the UK is unlawfully in the WHO. This week, I met with Dr. Tess Lawry. I, along with Dr. Tess Lawry, met with UK-based People's Lawyers, TPL, which produced a detailed research document explaining why WHO and membership therein is unlawful. And alternatively, it's null and void. The long and short of it is this group, the People's Lawyers, TPL, we, TPL, are now launching a new legal action for an injunction to reject the current IHR 2005 and proposed amendments, any future pandemic treaty, and any and all dictates from the WHO now and in the future being imposed upon us. So they're basically saying, we don't belong in the WHO, let's get out. And that's something you can do domestically. In this case, they're doing it in the UK. But the UK lawyers behind this are saying, it's a lot of other countries too, probably the US, because the law is very similar.
Meryl Nass has been doing a phenomenal job. She's got a new organization called Door to Freedom. And they've been meeting with country after country after country, she and a group of attorneys. And Shabnam is the head of CHD in Africa. Super, super amazing leader. And it's the same thing. They've been doing the same thing. And so these two have been going around the world talking with different countries and different people. And what they've discovered is the WHO says they have agreements, but they've never followed the WHO process. And and if you look at the legal niceties, you know, they're just lying. They're just lying that everybody agreed, or they're just lying they took a vote and got the vote. They're just lying that these agreements are in place. They're just making it up and lying.
It's just a marketing arm telling a bunch of lies.
Yeah.
And you got people in the U.S. going on. It's like, well, attack them in the U.S. Don't try to attack them on their own turf. They're just lying through their teeth. Right. Come back to the U.S. and say, what are we doing with this? They're liars. Why are we mixed up with these liars?
Well, one of the reasons the countries are mixed up is what has been said to Meryl and some of the attorneys is, if we don't go along with the charade and pretend that charade is true, then they will pull our loans, and it's back to the bankers.
Yeah, we don't want to win.
You know, we keep coming back to the bankers, and the fact that our credit is supporting a group of bankers who are issuing debt in our name and using that money to buy us.
Yeah, right. And, so again, you see the sovereign money function being parceled out to private parties and being abused by those parties.
Right, and so, you know, it's the same thing you and I talked. Remember when you wrote the Going Direct Reset? It's the same thing we talked about in the beginning. We're going to have to deal with that. We're going to have to deal with this money machinery and taking back the money machinery, because the bankers, you know, they really are the face of Oz. It's just a charade.
It's our credit. Charade.
It's a charade. Right.
They've got their puppets doing one in the military and in the healthcare sphere.
Right.
And in the medical profession, throughout the medical profession. They got them all controlled. It's money, money. Right. You heard Lloyd say, we got to spend more money. We need the money, man. It's the same thing in healthcare.
The reason the bankers can do this is they can send out the media team to assassinate you, you know, in the court of popular opinion, or they can send out the assassins to, you know, run your car off the road or poison you or kill you.
Yeah.
And the question is, they can't, if enough people stand up, they can't do it to everybody, but it starts with not believing the media machine.
It starts with not believing the media machine is right. Boy, you said a mouthful.
They don't have enough assassins to kill everybody. So, but if we keep believing the media machine, you know, it comes down to not believing the media machine. And that's why you gotta turn off, at a minimum, turn off all the corporate media.
I just tune it all out. I mean, even big alt media, I'm like, nah. Mm-mm. Okay, let's keep it going. Let's talk about an honest doctor, Peter Bregan, who will tell the truth. Peter and Ginger Bregan are recirculating. I think they have a Substack, but they did a lot of write-ups that didn't get published early on. Not really clear why, but they're republishing some stuff now. So we're going to turn to an older piece, but it bears repeating. It's a very important message here. Among the worst atrocities in American medicine ever. And remember, Dr. Peter Bregan is an expert witness on the plaintiff's side in a lot of cases. He's very careful. Here's the key paragraph here. The murder of COVID-19 patients. Okay, throughout the nation, patients diagnosed with COVID-19 are being held against their will and against the will of their families, while hospitals refuse them access to effective treatments, such as HCQ and ivermectin combined with other medications. Instead of helping the people in their care, the hospitals impose treatments like remdesivir and ventilation that do more harm than good and can be fatal, footnote from Bregan. They perpetrate these crimes against their patients, despite the efforts of families, attorneys, and outside physicians trying to rescue them, and even in defiance of court orders. Again, a footnote. That bears repeating because this is exactly what Rancor was saying,
right,
with excess mortality at the front end of the alleged pandemic. He's like, no, right, there was excess deaths to be sure, but those excess deaths showed up. They didn't follow what you would expect in a natural pattern. They followed
local phenomena.
Political boundaries, like states, right, very localized. He's saying exactly the same thing.
So Jackie DeVoe is coming out with a new documentary that looks like it's going to be really good. She's followed the pattern of basically people being euthanized in the hospitals. You know, families getting calls on Friday and saying, your dad's going to die, and Saturday night at midnight, so you want to come in and say goodbye. So how do they know he's going to die? Well, because they kill him. And we saw Polly's Polly Tommy's been going around with the new CHD bus, and I'm going to be over with her in Knoxville. The CHD bus is coming to Knoxville, and you can get the schedule on their website, but we're going to be over there with her. And we published an article at Solari called Stories from the Bus, John. She said people are showing up all over the country who are talking about how their loved ones have been murdered by the hospitals using remdesivir. And these are,
wow,
frightening stories. And they're coming, you know, they're coming all over the place. People are just coming to bus. She's interviewing them, and they're telling the stories of how they killed their relatives. So, and these are stories. So go to Solari and do a search for Stories from the Bus. You know, you've got to, if you go into the hospital, you've got to make sure that you are protected from these kinds of things. So you just need to know that some hospitals are very dangerous, and you've got to stay away from that COVID track. So,
yeah, you got to remember, walking into an American hospital, there's a good chance you're not walking out.
You know, I hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's terrible. But I've heard that from people in a variety of contexts who have, like, you know, on the lower end of the economic spectrum, they look at hospitals like that's a death trap. There's no right. way you're getting me into a hospital.
Well, you know, no during way. The litigation, I couldn't go to a doctor or hospital for, you know, a variety of, it's all politics, but it, because of that, it taught me to, you know, I tried every old timey recipe. I tried everything you could do to be your own doctor. And it was a great education. I would never have done it if I hadn't been forced to. And, you know, I truly now believe it saved my life. So yep. stay away.
Very, very well could have. Yep.
Yep.
Wouldn't surprise me a bit if it did. No.
Yep.
Okay, let's turn to our favorite subject, which is pushback. And remember earlier we said, you know, you powers that be, you're playing with agriculture and food. You're playing with fire. Next story, Telegraph. Farmers take the streets across Europe in net zero revolt that threatens EU policy as elections loom. Protests sweeping the continent take their cue from tractor demonstrations that delivered resounding success at the polls in where? In the Netherlands. How about that? In your neck of the woods. Okay, so what's going on? Tractors are or have been on the march in France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Belgium, and crucially, the Netherlands. Would tractor protests have become so ubiquitous were it not for the Dutch farmers whose fight was captured the attention of the likes of Donald Trump and Elon Musk? I personally don't think that had a lot to do with it. I think we'll get to the real reason they captivated attention down here. The farmers in the world's second largest agricultural exporting country were particularly incensed at the plans of Mark Rutte, the prime minister, to buy out and shut down farms to hit the targets. The demonstrations of the farmers struck a chord far beyond their rural base. Urban voters were also tired of Mr. Rutt, despite his long tenure, and voters turned out to Farmer Citizens Movement, the BBB, a party closely associated with the protest. That party won a landslide victory in the regional elections to become the largest party of all in the 12 Dutch provinces. And down here, you learn the kind of key to this whole thing. They're quoting a political science professor, I believe. He says, the narrative of the farmers has become connected to a more general story about the decline of national symbols, of national landscapes, of national traditional ways of life, a kind of nostalgic nationalism, he said. This, he said, had combined with the cost of living crisis and rising cost of food to transform once popular green policies into bread and butter economic policies. So the farmers is a powerful, very powerful political symbol because it's hitting people where it hurts, their food and their wallet.
Right. Although they describe the victory of the particular Farmers' Party as a success, I think things are a little bit more muddled because that party was very much defined to grab the support and move it into something more acceptable to the establishment. And the parties that have been most fighting for the farmers and telling the truth, you know, were harmed in the process. So,
yeah,
you know, that game continues to go on. But the great thing about what's happening in Europe is the farmers are the farming. The farmers and the fishermen are people who are very respected within their societies, and they've earned that respect. They're very intelligent. They're very capable. We're just about to send our Dutch farmers and fishermen theme to the printers. But if you know, it's all on the web and the interviews are all on the web, and you can see what a remarkable group of people this is, or examples of what a remarkable group this is. But what has finally happened, John, and it's taken a couple of years, is the farmers and the fishermen have figured out, oh, it's all a lie. It's just the whole thing is a complete lie. This has nothing to do with protecting the environment. It has to do with controlling the food system and stealing our businesses and stealing our assets and stealing our property rights. And the whole thing is a lie.
It's a lie. You're here to crush us out of existence, and we know it, and we're protesting. But you saw that laundry list of countries. This has just caught fire around the globe, around Europe.
Right, because once you come down to the fact that you're dealing with a criminal syndicate and everything they're saying is a lie, and the issue is one of individual and national sovereignty, you know, it gets simple. You just can't believe it's that simple. But once you get there, then you're like, okay, now I know what to do. They're trying to steal my stuff and poison me, and my job is to not let them.
They're trying to starve me to death.
Right.
That's what they're up to. It doesn't get much simpler than that.
Right.
And that farmer thing has really. That's why I say in the U.S. playing with agriculture like that, you're playing with fire, especially in the U.S.
If you want to help yourself, one of the things you can do is find your local farmers and ranchers and your local food businesses and support the bejesus out of them. Because, you know, this comes down to whether they can control the foods. You know, can they control the money and can they control the food supply? And they can't control the money unless they control the food supply. And the way to protect yourself from that is to get together with your local farmer and make sure you have fresh food to eat that doesn't poison you.
Right.
Right.
Right. That is a great point.
Right.
But let's keep it going with pushback. You know, in December of 2022, so a little bit over a year ago, you and I covered the story of the FBI seizing safe deposit boxes.
And I remember us saying, this is totally criminal. They can't do this. This is illegal. Right.
What was beyond the pale for me was that a district court judge went along with the FBI. I'm like, you have to be kidding me.
Right.
Well, here we go. We're back to that story. It's gone up a level. It's gone to the Court of Appeals. FBI seizures from safe deposit boxes violated U.S. Constitution, says Federal Appeals Court. The FBI seizure of contents from safe deposit boxes during a raid on Beverly Hills Vault in 2021 violated the U.S. Constitution, a federal appeals court ruled on January 23rd. By way of background, agents raided U.S. private vaults, a business that allowed people to rent safe deposit boxes anonymously, based on their belief that criminals were using the service. In other words, the agents. It's the agents, their belief that criminals were using the service. The search warrant stated that the agents could only open the boxes to inventory their contents and identify the owners for the return of their property. But the FBI reneged on that. When people who rented the boxes asked for the FBI for their belongings back after the raid, the FBI refused, saying it was going to file for forfeiture or transfer ownership to the government. The renters of the boxes then sued. The district court judge, to circle back to December 2022 at Money and Markets, the district court judge ruled in favor of the government, finding the search was covered by what's known as an inventory exception to the Fourth Amendment. But I guess in front of the Ninth Circuit, nope. During oral arguments, the appeals court panel compared the search to writs of assistance. This is so interesting. It compared the FBI to writs of assistance or unlimited searches executed by British authorities in pre-founding America. Huh. The court asked, how do we distinguish what you did from what the colonists were upset about and which led to the Fourth Amendment to begin with? We note that it's particularly troubling that the government, the FBI, has failed to provide a limiting principle to how far a hypothetical inventory search conducted pursuant to a warrant can go, said the judge. So it gets flipped. Unconstitutional.
So the FBI got their head handed to them and they deserve it completely.
Totally.
Totally.
And the district court did too. It's been remanded. Be interesting right. to see what the judge does with it. That, I can't believe the district court judge went with that.
I can because I've litigated with dirty judges, and I've seen them do very dirty things. I told you my favorite line was when Judge Stanley Sporkin, former CIA general counsel, said, we had a Supreme Court case on point. You had to do, it was about jurisdiction of where a trial should be. Could it be in the local court or the federal court? And it had to be, we had a Supreme Court case in the last year on point. It had to be in the local court. And my attorney, when the judge ruled against us, when Sporkin ruled against us, my attorney said, but Your Honor, we have a Supreme Court case. You know, it's the law. You have to do it. And he said, well, you know something, Mr. McManus, I disagree with the law. If you have a problem with that, take it up with Congress.
Wow.
I'm not going to obey the law. I don't have to.
It's not, I tell you what, though, Catherine, it's not just crooked judges. It's the crooked DOJ attorneys are pretty much the norm. Yeah. They get up there. They'll get there, lie through their teeth about precedent, lie through their teeth about facts. They'll make stuff up on the fly.
I saw it. I just saw complete and utter. I mean, it was outrageous. They felt
just
no
a total
obligation.
Disregard. Just
total
a
disregard
win at
for
all
facts.
Costs.
Total. Right.
Right.
Well, but I think the Department of Justice's job was the concentration and control of cash flow. So what I and my company were doing was making it difficult for the world to be safe for mortgage fraud. Yeah. And these guys literally had hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion, of mortgage fraud. And their job was to keep the bubble going.
It sure
and
was.
They don't need facts and they don't need law. They just need to bully their way through. It's a criminal syndicate.
If I were to give you a one-sentence summary of the judiciary insofar as foreclosures are concerned and mortgages are concerned, it's this. Bank of America foreclosed on a house on which there was no mortgage. He bought the house with cash.
Right.
That's your judicial system.
Well, but as you know, as we see in the pushback, it's not everybody. They don't own and control everybody, and there are honest judges, and we are getting good decisions.
That's the other thing. There's 850 members of the federal judiciary. You ain't going to get them all.
Right. Right. And, you know, ultimately, Sporkin had to leave. He got outed. We launched a website and that and another case. He got outed and out he went.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
no, we
great.
Had to get a lot of people fired to win.
Wow.
Yeah. We got the... When and transparency works, we would launch either a website or we'd launch a new article or a new thing, and we got the AG the IG at HUD finally had to get fired and Sporkin had to leave the bench and.
So you filed something, some paper within the judicial machinery that resulted in the judge getting ousted?
No, we launched a website.
A website.
We launched a website and brought transparency to what was really going on and made it accessible.
And the judge's departure occurred after the website launch?
Yeah. There were two things. He had two cases where transparency was very uncomfortable. Transparency was happening. And I think it was a combination of those two things. It wasn't just us, but it was something else.
Yeah. So it's not, in other words, the docket is transparent. You can go on a Pacer and look at items in the docket, but the public doesn't know about it, you know?
Well, here's the thing. This is exactly what's happening in Israel now, what happened to us, in that you have a situation which is unbelievably complicated. There's 12 different tracks of litigation. There's, you know, thousands of pages of documentation. There's allegations flying back and forth. And you've got the Department of Justice, you know, making these allegations, or a whistleblower making these allegations. And it's being handled, you know, the smear campaign is on in the media, right? Yeah. But the reality is we have the right, and it only took 11 years to push it through the courts and make them put forward evidence, which they could never do. I told you that was the, but it's a problem because it's complicated, and the media is supporting the Netanyahu bunch, and people don't know what to believe, and it's too complicated. And what we were able to do was put together a website, hyperlink all the documents, make everything accessible with summaries that could take it, you know, for a reporter to cover that story would take them a year. We brought that down to a week. They could cover that story in a week, and they had all the documentation. And we could cut through the complexity and tell the story, oh, they are committing genocide. Do you see what I mean? Yeah, and that's what this process in The Hague has done. They've been able to cut through the complexity and tell the story.
Right. And that opinion is not that long. It's 26, 27 pages.
Right. It's long, but, you know, it's clear from what they put in the opinion that you as a reader can make your own. You're saying, you know, if you look at some of the quotes of what the Israelis have said, you know, that they use to justify their discussion of intent, it's like, holy cow. So what is happening is the neocons have used these kinds of tricks for years and years and years. I mean, basically, I was up against the neocons in Washington. Mm-hmm. They've used these kinds of complexity and legal games and, you know, and had the Department of Justice playing ball. But finally, the trance is broken. And we are living through an unprecedented breaking of a trance, which has held the United States hostage for decades.
Holding North American hostage.
Right.
Where the trance is certainly extended to especially Canada. And even there, per our next story, the trance melting away. Here we go. Trudeau's Orwellian attack on Canadian truckers declared unconstitutional. How about that? Canada's federal court ruled on Tuesday that Trudeau's use of Emergencies Act in 2022 to punish protesting truckers was both unreasonable and unconstitutional. Says the court, the proclamation to Trudeau's proclamation does not bear the hallmarks of reasonableness, meaning justification, transparency, and intelligibility, wrote Judge Richard G. Mosley in his ruling. And he goes on, according to Mosley, Trudeau's regulations had violated charter rights, constitutional rights, particularly against the freedom of thought, opinion, and expression. The Emergencies Act order was also found to infringe on the right to security against unreasonable search and seizures. Chalk up another one for the judiciary, albeit in Canada. Good for them.
Right. But what I would point out, and it wouldn't surprise me, John, if this happened, because if you look at the bad PR the entire Anglo-American financial system has gotten as a result of this action, you know, it wouldn't surprise, it doesn't surprise me that they would roll it back. But I would note that all the truckers who were bankrupted by this, no restitution is coming.
That's a very excellent point.
Right.
It can, you know, the wheels of justice are slow, and you know, Trudeau got what he wanted. You know,
right?
You know, he's celebrating exactly what you just said. Then, you know, it's too late for a lot of people, not for everybody.
Right.
Anyway, let's turn to our last pushback story. It's a video. I love this opening frame because it's farmers and it's a symbol of all of this, what's wrong, and a big bale of something. So let's roll this video.
Sentier de bois, sentier de bois, la rencontre, trop vite oublié, va s'écrier.
Look at that. Anyway, that's so I was gonna say that's
I normally don't support those kind of protests, but I have to tell you, McDonald's deserves every part of it.
Yeah. Right.
Those are the French farmers?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can see from their faces they're having a good time with that. Like we said again and again on the show, you know, whatever complaint you might have about the French, they know how to throw a protest.
God love them. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Chart time. Yep. Let's hit it. Let's get into it right there.
So I mostly wanted to look at how the year is starting off. And I hate to say this, the plunder economy is starting off strong. So we see the, you know, best performance once again being the, you know, big tech and the plunder guys, and then the S&P a little bit behind. And interestingly, I wanted to point out China really lagging. Evergrande, the big property developer, has now, you know, finally been, the courts have ordered their liquidation. And so the housing bubble is now officially bursting in China. So China's got a lot to struggle with. And the big question, John, is if you look at what happened after the financial crisis, one of the things that sort of kept the economy going globally was massive increase in local and corporate debt in China. And part of that was the real estate and housing bubble. So big question as to what this is going to mean to the Chinese economy now. Anyway, and there in the middle is VGK, the European ETF. So I would say the markets have started, certainly the equity markets has started off strong, but again, it's not a good sign because the plunder guys are off to the races once again.
Boy, are they ever.
Yep. Yeah,
didn't take long.
Okay. And here's the thing, you know, if you look at this, the neocons and the syndicate, you know, what they would say is, well, game is working. Control grid is working. It's working in the stock market. But that depends on massive amounts and tsunami of money injections. I mean, the money system is really fundamentally, you know, antithetical to productivity now.
Yeah.
Everything is pouring tons of money into control. And you see it here. You see it in Tennessee, in the Tennessee legislature. The amount of money pouring in and the tsunami of complex legislation pouring in to build the control grid and the legislators trying to beat it back, it's a frightening game.
Yeah, it is. Okay, we'll see. We'll see how they're happy because the stock market's getting back to its usual tricks. We'll see that in a minute. But let's cut to the AGG.
Yeah, so I wanted to look at sort of the safety trade. And of course, precious metals down, but not as far down as TLT, the treasury. So interest rates have come off a little bit. We'll look at that in a second. You know, the Fed had said that their goal was a 4% target for the year and to bring it down to 4%. And that seems to be happening.
Yeah. But again, here we go. And FinViz, though, this is, look, remember last time.
One month,
right?
Right.
Remember last time we said, you know, VIX is unusual, but look at this. Remember for weeks and weeks, VIX was at the bottom of the basement, and last episode it was in the middle.
Right.
Look where it is now. It's back. It's creeping back down to the basement.
So you gotta hand it the bankers. They are able to exercise phenomenal control.
They are, and the same suspects are at the top. It's all the sweets, sugar, cocoa, orange juice, all back at the top. Anyway, it's reverting to its, the FinViz is reverting to its wallpaper status where the stock market is very stable and predictable and everything else is, anyway, up.
Okay. Well, but inflation clearly is not under control. So
if you know,
it's very interesting driving around the country. So today I'll drive over to Knoxville, driving around the country. When you see the inflation, I don't know if you've listened to the Dr. Michael Nell's interview at the Solari Report. It's one I strongly recommend. I just listened to it for the third time. He makes a very compelling case that many of the pandemic protocols, as well as whatever COVID was, but the injections really target the hippocampus, which lowers cognition ability. And part of it is putting in and keeping people in fear. It's very, very interesting. And he's really exceptional. It's, I think it's one of the most informative interviews I've ever listened to. And what you see driving around America, the amount of accidents are unbelievable. And every time I go on a long drive, I have to build another hour or two in to get around and deal with accidents. And wow. I think it really is related to people being under either getting physically poisoned or being under more stress or both. And
interesting.
And it's having phenomenal impact on productivity.
We'll have to make an effort to find data on that point.
I've been trying. Skidmore was looking for data on sort of traffic accidents, and I've been looking for data. But yeah, we need to do more, because if these are all the things, the implosion of different supply chains or traffic accidents, these are all things that dramatically eat into everybody's time each week.
I know that National Traffic and Safety Administration tracks highway miles.
Okay, so, I'll start digging.
NTSA might be a place to look at. But in the meantime, let's look at the dollar index. Look at this.
Dollar continues strong.
Wow.
Yep. Strong start, beginning of the year. That's why it's very important when you look at the criminal syndicate, you know, it's important to look at whether their money's working well or not. And so far, the going direct reset, as brutal as it is working well from a financial standpoint.
From a U.S. financial standpoint, yes.
Right, right.
Any idea why we see this breakpoint here?
No, I don't
know. Roughly January 15th?
Don't know.
I have no theory either, but that's an interesting, I mean, that's as close to a step function as you're going to get in a financial graph. And that's a step function.
Yep.
Anyway. Okay, let's keep it going. The Treasuries, 30-year.
Yep. And as we can see, we're moving towards the 4% target that the Fed set for this year. And we'll see the same with the 10-year. So
let's look at that.
It looks like rates are going up this year, but if you look at the full chart with last year, you know, we're down from the 5%, going over 5%.
For sure. And the 10-year, so look at that. And now the 10-year, look at that. Look how how closely that maps. Look at that.
Very close.
Amazing. Tight, very tight. Yeah.
So the yield curve from 10 years to 30 years is pretty flat.
Yes. Yeah. Earlier you had mentioned people's happiness with their political leaders. So that brings us to the status.
This chart is unbelievable.
Look at this.
Okay, so Brazil. So where trust in politics low. So this is the share of respondents who think that national politicians can't be trusted. So in Brazil, which we know is, you know, traditionally considered a very corrupt place, 37% believe that their national politicians can be trusted. In the United Kingdom, 35%. The United States, 29%. We are at the same as Mexico.
Yeah.
Germany, 24%. And that is a huge change for Germany.
That's right. A quarter of the population of Germans, they say they can't be trusted. Yikes.
No, well, 24%. Wait a minute. Share respondents who think that national
politicians can't be trusted.
Right.
These numbers strike me overall. I got to tell you, they strike me as low.
Yes. Very low. Very low. Very low.
Really? It's only 29% in the U.S.? The people I talk to would be more like 79 would be a closer number.
Right.
Well, anyway. It you know, when I saw this chart, I looked at, I said, well, maybe it's demographic. The average age in the U.K., the median age in the U.K. And anyway, it doesn't track. It's got no rhyme or reason. It's got nothing to do with age of people. Because the median age in Brazil. Brazil is like 32, and the United Kingdom it's like 39, in the U.S. it's 38, maybe it's 40 in the U.K., a little bit older.
So here's what's interesting, though. What I hear and see on the ground is more and more people realizing nothing is to be gained at the national level. In the United States, they have to make their progress either at state and local level or in their own lives with their community. You know, so people are looking at, they're getting out of the trance and looking at what's real. And that's very, very healthy.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay, let's turn to Larry in-house, see what's going on this week. Here we are.
So this week is my Tim Caban joined me for the wrap-up equity overview that we do four times a year. And we have just a discussion of how the markets did in 2023 and looking ahead in 2024 and going to some of the issues where we get a lot of questions on Ask Catherine. It's a great discussion. And Tim's going to be joining me. We're going to do an event in Philadelphia on the weekend. I think it's March 23rd. We'll announce it, I hope, as soon as we have a venue. But Tim will be there, and he's got a small Solari circle, so we'll be hanging out with his Solari circle as well when we're up there in March.
Nice. So you'll be over here a while.
Yeah, so I'm going to be here till the end of May.
Yeah,
we
wow.
have, well, we will see the website. Let's go down the list, and I'll show you where you can find the schedule.
Yeah, okay. Let's keep it going. Hero of the Week, Ryan Christian.
Yeah, so Ryan Christian is the editor of The Last American Vagabond, and he is unique in that he will really support major investigative journalist pieces. So he worked with Taylor Hudak for 6 months to get the Arne Burkhardt interview. He supported Whitney Webb and Derek Bowes and really will support these extraordinary deep dive efforts that really produce quality, you know, quality journalism. So, yeah. And you know, it's a very important role, but it doesn't get a lot of kudos and attention. And Ryan is one of the people who's unique in the alternative media for supporting those really high quality deep dives. And I'm very grateful to him. And I would point out he's also in Franklin, Tennessee, and very interested in local, you know, supporting the great local legislators.
Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, we need more of the deep dive longer pieces, in my opinion. I mean, they're very important. It's kind of a dying art.
The thing, if you look at the really great short videos, they go because, you know, behind them there's a summary, and then behind them there's a deep dive.
Yeah.
And so the right people are comfortable with the shorty. And so for the shorty to really go, you need the deep dive.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's expensive and hard to do the deep dive. And it's hard to find publishers who'll support it. So.
Very. Yeah. So Larry does. It's good.
Yeah. So does John Titus in Best Evidence.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Let's keep it going with a book review. What's this?
So Will Harris has the most popular or the most successful regenerative farm in the country. His family was in the farming business in Georgia, and he's built White Oak Pastures Farm. He's got a new book called A Bold Return for Giving a Damn. And when I was at Western Price, he said, you know, I told him, we're going to write a book review, so I want to do an interview with you. And they're now the biggest employer in their county. I mean, it's a huge and very profitable operation. Anyway, so Pete Kennedy, who hosts our food series, read the book and did a great review. And anyway, so Will Harris, if you're interested in regenerative farming, it's a great success story.
That's awesome. Again, it look, Georgia makes an appearance again. Very cool. Okay, now we've got state bullion depositories.
Okay, so this one was Catherine getting upset. So I think part of the infrastructure you need at the state level to protect sovereignty is you need a way to transact dollars that allows both the citizens, the banks, and the state to transact dollars without being turned into the Canadian truckers, you know, or having their money frozen and having to spend a year in the courts to prove that it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And so part of it is dollar transaction, but another part of it is being able to hold gold and silver and precious metals and both for the state and the citizens within the state. And so having a bullion depository is a very attractive piece of any financial infrastructure. And it's funny, people will say to me in Tennessee, well, why do we need to buy gold and silver? And I said, well, did you notice that all the central banks around the world are buying more and more and more? Why do you think that is?
Yeah.
Anyway, so,
and to be clear, the depository is for a person in that state. So you might hold a kilogram bar. You're not comfortable having that in your house.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
As long as
I
you can
tell
trust
you
your
how
state.
How many people I know in Tennessee, if the state had a bullion depository, You know, they would, that's where they would keep their gold and silver. Anyway, but in the process of talking with legislators in various states about doing the bullion depository, you get all sorts of kooky proposals, which don't help sovereignty. They make it worse. So
really?
Having a state bullion depository with all your systems run by Bill Gates, how is that going to help you with sovereignty?
That for sure is not going to help.
I finally realized, okay, I've got to have a detailed description of what the conditions are of a state bullion depository you need to make sure it really does contribute to sovereignty instead of being part of the problem. You know, how do you do it? So this was a, you know, Solari paper number one was written for the campaigns on what are the real problems with the federal credit and what do we need to do? And then this one is, okay, what's a state bullion depository and what are the terms and conditions of how you operate it and run it to make sure it really does help with sovereignty instead of, you know, it's part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Not part of the ongoing theft, ongoing genocide.
Well, it was really funny because I walked into one legislator's office yesterday in Tennessee and he had the paper printed out on his desk and he said, you know, I read the whole thing. And he said, this really helped. This is really good. I couldn't believe he read the whole thing because they are
very busy
people.
Yeah, exactly. That's a tall ask.
But it's the deep dive. You don't need everybody to read it. You just need a few of the people who go through the detail to go through and get the detail, and then you can be off to the races.
Even one person who can say, you know, hey, I read it. Here's what it says is very helpful.
Right. So I'm also going to do another piece now for them on. If you're going to make your gold and silver transactional with digital systems, what are the specifications you need to do deals with private party that would make it work, you know, and keep it sovereign? So I've got more coming.
Okay. That's awesome. Let's wrap it up with this financial transaction freedom.
Okay. So this is a website we brought up because we're going to be putting updates out to people in Tennessee about what's going on in the legislature and how we need them to contact their senators and representatives to support. So we're working with a group of legislators who are really trying to protect financial transaction freedom. And the more popular support we can have for this, the better. And on this website, you can sign up for the updates, but we've put a schedule and we're doing a lot of meetups. I'm going to be doing a lot of meetups with Solari Report subscribers. So tonight I drive over to Knoxville and we're going to be part of the CHD bus event in Knoxville on the 1st. And then somebody on Friday is having a meetup with for Solari Report subscribers in Knoxville. So you definitely want to plug into that if you're in the Knoxville area. But if you go to the website, you can click from the homepage. If you go to the Financial Transaction Freedom, you can sign up for updates if you're in Tennessee. We may have updates lists for other states. We'll see. But you can see the schedule. And between now and May, I'm going to be meeting up with subscribers all over the everywhere from South Dakota to Florida to Texas. So all over the country.
Wow.
Anyway, but check out the schedule and you'll see the location and the fact that it's a Solari Report meetup. What we'll do is we'll be sending out emails and saying, if you're interested in these locations, contact the host. So these are being organized by the Solari Report subscribers, not by us.
That's great.
Yeah, many people have volunteered. And we're going to have one in the first weekend in March in North Carolina. And we think you're coming.
Yeah, I am for sure.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Okay, so you can get to meet John Titus himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a frightening prospect, but, you know.
He's even funnier in person.
Anyway, the link to the Financial Transaction Freedom Financial Transaction website will be the very last link in the show notes today.
Okay.
Because it's our last.
And you can link to it on the from the homepage, too.
Okay, great.
Okay, so our theme was the pretend is over, and
boy,
it is really over. And I will tell you, as I go through my life, it makes the world seem a lot less coherent, and because nobody has a new, you know, the pretend is over, and so the official narrative is breaking down, but there's no new narrative.
Yeah.
Right. So
There's no new narrative.
Right? Yeah, so,
there's just doubling down. That's all there is.
Right.
Louder screaming to believe the current narrative, which nobody believes.
Right, but we need our own narrative.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we need our own narrative. And it's one of the things I've discovered is I was just talking to a dear ally yesterday who was terribly depressed. And I said, don't be depressed. This is what their failure looks like. You know, this is all part of getting to where we have to go. So just keep turtling forward, because this is what, it's what an ally of mine used to say, since the bigger the breakdown, the bigger the breakthrough.
Absolutely. 100% right. Correct. But your point is well taken. We do need our own narrative.
We do.
Yeah. So
we do.
With that, we will look forward to future episodes and our own narrative.
Okay, John, thank you for a great week. Thank you for some great video cutouts.
Yeah,
that one with Glenn Greenwald, he just aces them.
Yeah, he kills them. So anyway, sorry about the glitchy audio this week. We'll fix that next week. But those were some good videos.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful week. John and I will be back next week in the first week of, this will run in the first week of February.
February 1. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Have a great day. Bye.